It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin produces more cranberries than any other state, and half of the world's supply. Growers take a lot of water, and they've upgraded technology over the years to help conserve it. Maureen McCollum has the final report in our series this week on sustainability.
Water is used in every aspect of cranberry production. Most of the water is used to irrigate the crop in the large rectangular beds the fruit grows in. Those are also called bogs or marshes. When it's time for harvest, farmers flood the beds, causing the bright red cranberry to float. This makes it easier to pick the fruit. Cranberry producers flood the beds again in winter and encase the vines in ice for protection, and again in the spring to kill off any pests. Water is constantly moving back and forth from beds to the farm's retention ponds to natural rivers. At Fred Prain's farm outside of Toma, harvest season is wrapping up. Water is draining from the beds back into the public waters.
Basically, this goes down to Lemoore River. It's our main water source.
Prain is like many producers in Wisconsin, who's switching over to a more efficient farming operation. He says installing technology that monitors the temperature and moisture in the soil has made the biggest difference. Prain's also a dentist, so when he's not on the farm, he can check on his cranberries from his office by a computer or smartphone app.
I sit up between patients up in Wausau when I'm not down here, and I can watch the soil monitor, and I can say go down, and I make a phone call down. Of course, my staff's all got iPads, and they're basically watching it too.
Prain says the technology has drastically cut back on the amount of watering, since they know exactly how much moisture is in the soil. That also saves on fuel and energy used to pump water into the beds. A University of Wisconsin study found that 57% of producers are now using soil monitoring programs. That's up more than 20% from 4 years ago. Just a few miles away, third-generation cranberry grower Ed Grigleski starts his pickup truck to drive around his cranberry beds. He's also taken steps to reduce how much water is used on his family's farm, but it's hard to tell how much water they've saved. That's because cranberry growers are regularly reusing water from nearby streams and retention ponds.
You know, we use a lot of water, but we are on watersheds, and the water is there regardless if we're there or not. And it flows through our marsh. We use it to irrigate and to flood, and we return it back into the same water source.
Cranberry farmers have a pretty good deal with Wisconsin. A 140-year-old state law allows cranberry producers to use and dam the water for free on their property. Most growers say they don't want to abuse that, so they do their best to conserve their water sources. They're also paying attention to how water is running low in some parts of the country. Although dwindling water supplies are not a problem in most of Wisconsin, producers are doing what they can to make sure they always have water. Nicole Hansen serves on a number of agriculture and sustainability boards and is the plant health manager at Cranberry Creek Cranberries, one of the largest producers in the state.
Because the nation is concerned about water, as an industry, absolutely we want to be proactive. And that's one of the really amazing things about the cranberry industry is the fact that the cranberry industry is very progressive, very involved in trying to stay ahead.
Plus, Hansen, like many producers, wants to make sure there's enough water so her children can work on the same cranberry farm. Maureen McCollum, Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse.
Our sustainability series is part of the National of the Science Journalism Project, Quest. Support comes from the National Science Foundation. You can see stories from around the country at questscience.org.
Tonight on Wisconsin Public Television, tune in at 7:30 for the Wisconsin premiere of Quest episodes focused on farming, water, and energy. Learn more at WPT.org. A statewide program run by the UW-Madison Center for the Humanities aims to bring world literature into Wisconsin high school classrooms. And this Monday, students will get a chance to meet the Nobel Prize-winning novelists they've been reading this year.
Gabriella Ekman and Heather Dubois-Bornon are organizers of Great World Texts in Wisconsin.
Gabriella, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Heather, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having us.
So first, tell us, just the broad strokes, what is the Great World Texts program?
Great World Texts program is
a public humanities initiative of the Center for the Humanities at UW-Madison. And basically what we do is we try to bring a different work of world literature into as many high school classrooms throughout the state as we can in a given year. So every year we pick a book, schools compete to participate in the program, and we give them grants and facilitate their teaching of the text for the entire school year, and then they bring their students to Wisconsin-Madison for a big student conference, usually in the spring, but this year we're having it next week on December 2.
And why is it important? Why do we want to connect our high school students in Wisconsin with these works of world literature?
Well, obviously, students throughout Wisconsin are already reading literature in Wisconsin classrooms, and we have excellent English teachers in all of our school districts that participate. But what we try to do is select texts that are really challenging, that invite interdisciplinary teaching, and that might pose a challenge that teachers are unable to face without additional support. So oftentimes, these are classics that might be long or difficult for teachers to facilitate the teaching of, or it might not seem to fit with their curriculum in other ways. And so we provide the resources to get these teachers to teach books they might not otherwise teach.
And Gabriella, let's bring you in here now. So we have a special event coming up on Monday. The students are going to meet the author that they've been reading in the program this year. Tell us about the author.
So Orhan Pamuk is a Turkish novelist. He won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2006. He's written a number of novels, and he's been translated into more than 60 languages. So he really is, in many ways, a novelist who both travels to a lot of different countries and now also to Wisconsin. So we're really excited to have him.
Now, this is not an opportunity I had in high school, I'll say, to meet a Nobel Prize winning novelist that I've been reading. How unique is this for something like this to happen?
I think it is extremely unique. And I think it's also a really wonderful opportunity for students to engage with a great writer, to sort of understand that he is, on the one hand, a wonderful novelist whose book they've been talking about for many months, but also a human being, mm-hmm. You know, who has foibles and who, you know, is either charming or perhaps less so, we don't know yet. But all of those things are part of, you know, humanizing literature and really making it real and alive for students.
And do you think that helps them appreciate the literature more, having that face and hearing the voice of the author?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it also, I mean, some of the students who'll be coming are aspiring writers themselves. Mm. And so for them in particular, I think it's a really wonderful opportunity to talk to somebody who, you know, has done so well with his own writing and is willing to engage with them on their level as well.
And tell us about the book. It's Snow.
Yeah. So Snow is a novel about a poet who's been living in exile, a Turkish poet who's been living in exile in Germany for many years. And he returns to Turkey and travels to eastern Turkey on a very snowy evening. And he arrives in a very small town, very isolated town called Kars. And he does so ostensibly to research the suicides of epidemic of young girls who've been committing suicide, but actually, as it turns out, to reconnect with an old love. And so on the one hand, it's a love story, it's a political story, it's a story about Eastern and Western Turkey and about Turkey's relationship to its own history and to the rest of the world. And it just stages and interrogates all of those questions in a really fascinating, rich way.
Let's talk about what's been happening in the classrooms with this book now. Heather, first of all, what in the past have students in this program been doing when they get a book for the year and they sit down in class? What happens?
Well, that varies widely depending on what kind of teaching team they have in place at their school. We have all kinds of schools participating in this program, from huge public schools like Madison East, where over 200 students are engaged in reading this novel with four different teachers,
wow,
to tiny rural schools with only one participating teacher in one English classroom. We also have some private schools and charter schools participating. So there's a big range of how big the interdisciplinary teams are and how focused on, say, literature as opposed to history and what angle the teacher has in mind for teaching the text. We try to facilitate all different kinds of teaching. I should also note that the students themselves range in age and ability, too. So some students might be in their AP English and History classes. Others may be ESL students who are just learning English or who are, you know, in a remedial English course. So we have a big challenge on our end of making sure that our materials are of value to teachers across that range.
And you worked on those materials, Gabriella. How do you make it that flexible for all those possible uses in confronting the same book?
Well, that's a good question. And what I tried to do in writing the instructor's guide was both to offer a lot of creative ways of engaging with the text, as well as, so for instance, writing a book of poems that's very thematic in the text, as well as other kinds of engagements. I mean, the entire guide is organized thematically. And so we talk about issues of history, we talk about issues of world literature and who has access to it, questions of politics and gender, et cetera. And so all of those different kinds of ideas, I think, allow students to have access to them, depending on sort of, I mean, questions of gender are things that everyone can kind of relate to. Issues of clothing, you know, the headscarf debate is a very big one in the novel. And bringing that to students and having them think about their own religion and their own sort of attitude towards religious choice is one way of sort of addressing that.
We're talking about the Great World Text Program with organizers Heather Dubois-Bornan and Gabriella Ekman. It brings students from around Wisconsin together to read a text, a book of world literature, and in this case to meet the Nobel Prize-winning author in Madison next Monday.
We'll pick up this conversation in a few minutes. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time. Coming up, we'll hear about some potentially dangerous toys to avoid this holiday season.
Now we pick up our conversation with Gabriella Ekman and Heather Dubois-Bornan, organizers of the Great World Texts in Wisconsin program. So, Heather, what kind of response have you gotten from the people participating in this program, teachers and students for that matter?
Well, to quote one of our teachers, one of our returning and veteran Great World Text teachers, his name is Alex Branderhorst. He teaches at Washington High School in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. He's participated for, I think, 5 or 6 years. He describes what happens at the conference as being transformative for his students. We've had over 6,000 students come through our program over the past 9 years. It's 1,300 participating throughout the state this year. And what our program does is it allows teachers to customize their teaching around a text, and it allows students to start to see themselves as part of an intellectual, kind of more academic, discursive community in a new and really empowering way.
And that's part of the interesting thing. It isn't just read a book, do a report. It's within the schools, I imagine, there's that kind of collaborative discussion. And then this big thing at the conference. Gabriella, how important is that part, that it's not just reading and reporting on it?
Oh, no, I think that's huge. I mean, the students come here, they get to be in Madison, they get to interact with other students and see how other students from other schools have responded to the text and created projects in response to them. So I think that's a really big deal. They get to also, some of the students who've written essays get to discuss their essays with other people from different high schools and also in groups facilitated by undergraduates here at UW-Madison. So those undergraduates then kind of model what college discussion and college critical thinking looks like.
And that reminds me, I'd read a piece about this program. I think it was a teacher from the Trempealeau area talking about, you know, we're in a smaller town. I want my students to be ready for the college experience, even though they don't live down the street from a big institution like UW-Madison, say. How big a part of that is this?
That's something that we just think is huge and take really seriously. And part of it is demystifying what the college experience is like and having students just be able to come here and say, yeah, I could fit in here. I can feel comfortable here. This is fun and exciting. But also having them realize that the college conversation isn't necessarily just a conversation they could someday be a part of. It's a conversation they already are a part of in a meaningful way, that they've already done the thinking and the work that has engaged them at that level. And that's something that we just see over the course of the day of the conference, them start to own and feel proud of. And it's really an exciting thing to see and a rewarding one.
Does the program, like with Snow, the book, does it keep going after the conference? Are they still going to be working on the book after this?
Our program is year-round for the period of engagement for the teachers, but our materials are become part of our permanent collection.
Okay.
So any teacher anywhere in the world can go to our website right now, humanities.wisc.edu, and download our teaching guides for Snow or any previous text. This is our ninth book, so all of the teaching guides that we've done in the past are still online. We continue to update those files, and we encourage teachers to make use and continued use of these resources. We give the schools copies of each text for their permanent collection, so we hope that they continue to teach these texts over the years as well.
So a teacher listening out there right now could go to the website and pull this material and do this book?
And we hope they do.
What's that website, in case I forget to ask you later?
Yeah, humanities.wisc.edu.
That's a great resource.
And then just go to the Great World Text tab.
So who are some of the authors and books you've tackled in the, you said, 9 years of the program?
Yeah. Snow is our ninth text. We've done Dante's Inferno.
Wow.
Don Quixote.
Yeah. That's heavy.
Yeah. It's
I don't know.
Stuff teachers,
I don't know if I'm ready for that one.
Stuff teachers may not want to teach without a little bit of extra help. The Brothers Karamazov, which of course is daunting just because of its length. 100 Years of Solitude by Garcia Marquez. Things Fall Apart by Chinua Achebe, Antigone, the Greek classic, and 1001 Nights, Arabian Nights. And then last year we did The God of Small Things by Arundhati Roy, who was our keynote at last year's conference. So we've already had a glimpse of what it's like when the students get to meet the author. Mm-hmm. And it was just an amazing experience. We can't wait to recreate next week.
So you still, obviously some of the authors you mentioned would not be available to come to the conference. But so what do you do at a conference when the author isn't there? There's still a lot to talk about.
Right. We like to look at who would be somebody who could really engage students at the level where they're thinking about the text. We've historically gone with the translator of the text to kind of open up that conversation about what it means to translate culture and to translate meaning and interpretation. When we did Things Fall Apart, Chinua Achebe, who's since passed on but was alive and ill at the time, couldn't make it to our conference. So we invited a contemporary Nigerian novelist, Chris Abani, who has kind of modeled his own writing career on the works of Chinua Achebe and sees him as kind of a father figure in his own writing. And so that was an interesting conversation for students to have.
Interesting. Gabriella, we've talked some on the show about how people, kids and grown-ups for that matter, can understand others, understand people from different parts of the world through the medium of stories, by hearing stories told. Is that something that excites you about the Great World Texts program, that they have this opportunity?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's one of the reasons why the Great World Texts program is so wonderful, because it brings all of these different stories that high school students might not otherwise have access to into the classroom and into something that that they're a part of and that they can talk about. I mean, yes, Dante's Inferno is a challenging text, but it is also one that, it's really vivid. It's really scary. I mean, there are lots of points of access for students in a lot of these texts, even though, maybe they wouldn't otherwise read it.
You teach some college classes, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Are you a little envious of this program? Do you wish you get your college students sneak them in?
Absolutely. I met with our undergraduate volunteers yesterday, and a lot of them were saying how much they would have wanted to have a program like this in their classrooms when they were in high school, because of the way that it brings just the world and world issues and engagement with other cultures and intellectual ideas into their classrooms.
So, Heather, looking at the future, are you already picking out next year's book, next year's author?
Yes, we have. Next year, we're going to be working with The Confessions by Jean-Jacques Rousseau. So kind of going back to an older version of Great World Texts and thinking about how that text has influenced writing since its own publication.
And who have you thought about who will be the keynote on that one? Or is that still far enough off?
We've made an invitation. We have somebody in mind, but we're waiting to see if he's accepted. I think people will be excited.
And speaking of excited, Gabriella, meeting Orhan Pamuk, pretty exciting?
Yes, definitely. I think it will be wonderful.
Okay. Well, thank you both so much for joining us today. I appreciate it. Heather, thanks.
Thanks for having us.
Gabriella, thanks to you.
Thank you for having us.
And good luck on the event on Monday. I know a lot of preparation has gone up to it.
We forgot to say Varsity Hall in Union South on December 2. So it's open to the public. And Orhan Pamuk will be giving a public lecture that same night at 7:30 p.m. in Varsity Hall of Union South. Our conference is from 8:30 to 3:30 during the day.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Gabriella Ekman and Heather Dubois-Bornan, organizers of the Great World Texts in Wisconsin program. And we'll link to info about the event and that program on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, a look at toys to avoid when we do our holiday shopping. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
As we approach one of the biggest shopping days of the year, Black Friday, many parents are eager to find the latest and greatest toys to buy as Christmas gifts.
But according to our next guest, there are still toys on short store shelves that are unsafe for kids. A new report lays out the most dangerous toys this holiday season and what you should stay away from.
Joining us now is Bruce Spate. He's the director of the Wisconsin Public Interest Research Group. We've got a link to his group's report, Trouble in Toyland, on the Central Time Facebook page. Bruce, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Veronica. Thanks for having me on.
Well, the year 2013, at this point, we kind of assume that toys on store shelves are going to be safe, at least I do, but your report shows otherwise. So how widespread is the problem of unsafe toys?
Well, unfortunately, every year there are a number of toy-related injuries and even deaths that are reported to the Consumer Product Safety Commission. So we have seen progress over the years, a reduction in the number of toys that's being recalled, and a reduction in the number of toy-related injuries, but they're still occurring. So we need to keep at it and not only make sure consumers and parents are aware of common hazards, but also fight for stronger standards to make sure that unsafe toys aren't ending up on the shelf.
Well, what are some of those common hazards that we should be on the lookout for?
Yeah, well, each year our report, Trouble in Toyland, looks at the data collected by the Consumer Product Safety Commission and, what are the hazards or the injuries, rather, that are being reported. And this year we highlighted four hazards that continue to really pose hazards to our littlest consumers. And those four hazards are choking hazards, toxics in toys, magnetic toys, and excessively noisy toys.
Okay, so the one, I guess, that stands out to me the most is the toxicity stuff. Now, I know that a while ago we were getting a lot of news stories about unsafe levels in products from China. That doesn't seem to be what's making headlines these days, but there still seems to be a lot of toxicity in toys that are out there. What sorts of things should we be aware of?
Yeah, well, this is a really important hazard to talk about, and it's one where we need strong standards in place because this is an invisible hazard. No parent or caregiver can look at a toy and know if it contains a toxic chemical. The most common toxic chemicals we're finding are lead, cadmium, antimony. These are all heavy metals that are toxic, but also phthalates, which are a PVC plastic, used to soften PVC plastics. So We are finding a number of toys in the market still that contain those toxic chemicals, and really the solution here is to make sure that we put in place strong standards that never allow a toy with a toxic chemical like lead or phthalates to end up on the shelf.
Now, so, phthalates is, that's something that awareness is just cresting on in the last couple of years as people have become aware that it's an endocrine disruptor, among other things. But lead and cadmium, why are these showing up in toys at all?
Yeah, I know. It is shocking. And as you pointed out, back in 2008, there was a massive recall of toys primarily from China that had lead in the paint and the surface coatings. And, fortunately, we have seen far fewer recalls for toys that contain lead, but it still occurs. And we really have made progress. In fact, this year is the first year in eight where we've seen a really dramatic reduction in the number of recalls. But it still occurs, and we have to remain vigilant and make sure that we're holding manufacturers accountable and that we're testing toys before they get to the market to prevent exposure to toxic chemicals.
Can you give us the names of a few toys that we should avoid?
Sure. Well, we did highlight 30 different toys in our report this year. In terms of phthalates, there was a Ninja Turtles pencil case that had 150 times the legal limit for phthalates. And our concern with this toy is that some might argue it's a pencil case, it's not really a toy, and so it shouldn't be regulated as a toy. But, you know, of course, products like this can easily end up in the mouth of a younger sibling. And so we really think that standard should be applied even to a pencil case. And after all, it is a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle pencil case, so it would have appeal for young kids. But then we also found a Marvel Superheroes soft shield that had 2,900 parts per million lead, which is, you know, the legal limit for lead is 100 parts per million. So, you know, this is way beyond what's allowable. So, so again, it's being vigilant and making sure that we're testing these toys before they get on the shelves and have the strong standards in place.
Now, we looked at some of the toxicity issues. You also look at choking hazards as well as noise hazards. So let's go to choking hazards. Now, these are toys which have little tiny pieces that can cause choking and sometimes death if we're not careful. What are you seeing out there in terms of choking hazards?
Yeah, well, this is a big concern. Every year, for many years now, choking has been the leading cause of toy-related injuries. And whether it's balloons or balls or a toy or even a part of a toy, which is what we most commonly find, kind of accessories to toys that can easily, you know, come off the toy or are separate from the toy that end up being small and pose a choking hazard. So we continue to see a number of those products that are really too small and pose a choking hazard. The way the law is written, if a toy fits within a choke test cylinder that's 1.25 inches in diameter, if it fits in there, it can't be sold for a child under 3. If it's intended for children between the ages of 3 and 6, it has to have a choke hazard warning, which listeners might be familiar with. It's a standard warning that appears on toys. And we've actually advocated for two strengthenings of that standard. One is let's make it a bigger standard because children are choking on toys that are near small parts. So, you know, they're not fitting in that choke test cylinder, but they still pose a choking hazard. And any rounded object, there should be a stronger standard for as well, because we know that balls and rounded objects pose a particular choking hazard. So we not only need to do work to make sure we prevent the toys which shouldn't be out on the market and pose a choking hazard from getting out there in the first place, but we also need to strengthen the standard to better protect our littlest consumers.
So if parents want to strengthen that standard, want more testing, what is the best avenue to take?
Well, this is really action that needs to be taken by the Consumer Product Safety Commission and by Congress. Our toy safety standards are written by Congress, and in fact, in the wake of the recall that occurred back in 2008 around lead and paint, some of these standards were strengthened, but not the standard for small parts. So, you know, we really need to contact our members of Congress and the Consumer Product Safety Commission and urge them to strengthen these standards. And one other tip I'd offer regarding choking, we urge parents to actually use something they can easily find at home to test for choking hazards, and that's an empty toilet paper roll. It is a little larger than the choke test cylinder, and of course, it's easily accessible for parents. If a toy fits in that, you certainly shouldn't give it to a child under 3, but really should be watchful for any young child with a toy that fits in that empty toilet paper roll.
And what are a few toys on the market that don't pass muster?
Yeah, well, we did find a number of them this year. There were a few Littlest Pet Shop toys, which, you know, are small little pets that children are buying that actually violated the choking standard. They weren't labeled with a choke hazard warning, and they were intended for children ages 4 and up. So, you know, really it's and I should generally say, you know, our report is less about the specific toys that are listed and more about making sure that parents and consumers are thinking about these hazards when they're shopping for toys, keeping in mind that these are common hazards, things they should look out for, and really just to be vigilant and make sure they're not purchasing toys that might pose these hazards. I think at the end of the day, this is about using common sense and making sure that, you know, if a toy sounds too loud when you put it to your ear, you know, it's probably not going to be good for your child's ears. Or if it has small parts, you know, be watchful about that as well.
Right. And you mentioned noise and being something being too loud for our ears. And that's something that I think a lot of people wouldn't be that aware of, whether something's too loud. Kids' culture does seem to be loud these days. Why do we have to be worried about noisy toys?
Yeah, well, actually, noise is a big concern. The Institute on Deafness and Other Communication Disorders estimates that 1 in 5 children has some hearing loss by the age of 12. We know that they're exposed to a lot of loud sounds, and certainly toys are one common source. We had 3 toys on our list this year, which exceeded the standard of 65 decibels for a toy 1 inch from the ear, and the standard of 85 decibels if a toy is measured 10 inches from the ear. So there are loud toys out there, and you know, it really is that, well, the best way to test is if it, again, sounds loud to your ear, then it's probably inappropriate for your child. But another thing parents can do is tape over the speaker or just take the batteries out if a toy sounds too loud and you already have it.
All right. Well, Bruce, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.
We've been talking to Bruce Spaeth, the director of Wisberg, and we've got a link to the report Trouble in Toyland on the Central Time Facebook page.
In the 1980s, author Thomas Gagin wrote that Chicago was the last great American city not yet ruined by yuppies. Today, our next guest says Chicago has become a city that, in fact, works for the rich, a place full of foodies with manicured parks and lots of hipsters around.
Meanwhile, the poor have been pushed out of gentrifying neighborhoods, and Chicago leads the nation in homicides. Thomas Frank from the Midwest himself sees this kind of disparity as the future for many gentrifying cities.
Thomas Frank is the founder and editor of The Baffler magazine. His most recent book is called Pity the Billionaire. He joins us now to discuss his column in December's issue of Harper's Magazine. It's called Chicago is the Future. Thomas, welcome to Central Time.
How are you today?
I'm good. And you?
Dandy.
All right. Well, you call Chicago of the 1980s an ugly city. What was it like? You lived there at the time.
Well, you know, the funny thing is I'm quoting someone saying that. I didn't think that at the time. I loved the place. But when I think back about what I liked about it, yeah, it was pretty ugly. It was, you know, it was this rotting, industrial town, sort of at the end of the industrial era. A lot of really, and Chicago still has a lot of really grand public buildings, but it was grandiosity back then. It was grandiosity of a different kind. You know, everything was enormous, vast, empty, crumbling, rusting. You know, litter strewn everywhere. That's what I remember. But the funny thing is, I really liked that.
And you say that it was a Chicago in transition. In fact, it hadn't even really transitioned from deindustrialization. And there was something that you really reveled in, that kind of Chicago that hadn't caught up yet.
Yeah, it was a real city. So I'm from Kansas City. And Kansas City, I imagine, was a real city once too. But over the decades, Kansas City has developed this really bad case of urban sprawl or suburban sprawl, I guess you'd say. You know, it has no mass transit to speak of, and it's this gigantic place with no urban core. And Chicago had all the things that that cities were supposed to have. You didn't have to drive if you didn't want to. It had famously a tavern on every street corner. It had industry, it had manufacturing still. There were still steel mills in Chicago back in the 80s. It had all that stuff. And, of course, it had the suburbs too. And great university, lots of people doing experimental things in the arts, you know, often uncelebrated. And it was wonderful. I just was, I had a great time there.
You went back recently, and that's the core of your piece. What do you see as Chicago today? What has changed?
Well, so I moved away 10 years ago, and that was originally the impetus for writing this essay, is go back to Chicago after 10 years and see what it looks like, what's changed. And specifically, I lived in the South Side in a neighborhood called Hyde Park, which is where the University of Chicago is. And it's also where the President of the United States comes from. So, you know, obviously a lot has changed there in the last – when I moved out of Chicago, he was our state senator, Barack Obama was. And, you know, now I'm going back, and he's, of course, the president. And so the most obvious thing is the changes that are related to that. For example, the street that he lived on is completely blocked off by the Secret Service, and they won't let you drive through, and they won't let you walk through. You just can't get through, period. And that has in turn allowed for all sorts of gentrification in the neighborhood around it, you know. And what was funny is that when I went back to Chicago, this was back in September, I guess, and it was when there were this really horrifying series of shootouts going on in the city, and the Chicago had won had the most murders of any city in America, the most homicides, and there was that going on. But when I walked around in these neighborhoods in what I call the green zone, what my friends there refer to as the green zone, you know, like in Baghdad, it was so perfectly safe that you wouldn't even know that these incredible shootouts were going on 20 blocks away or something. You wouldn't even know it. It was a different world.
Now, it sounds like you're describing this sort of upstairs-downstairs phenomenon that's happening in Chicago, but it also sounds like that gentrification rubbed you the wrong way a little bit in Chicago. It got a little overly precious. But when we talk about gentrification in a lot of cases, you know, there's often less crime in that area, there's less urban blight, and is there something wrong with a gentrified Chicago as you see it?
The things that you mentioned are very true. For example, you know, one of the best way to get crime out of a neighborhood is to make the rent really expensive. You know, this is well known. And that has certainly happened. And so the sort of, you know, massive kind of gentrification that's gone on in a place like Chicago has made the sort of green zone phenomenon possible. And it's really nice to be in the zone, right? It's a much prettier city today than it was when I left. The food is better. We'll get to that in a minute, I imagine. There's lots of great things about it. On the other hand, the problem with gentrification obviously is that it prices a lot of people out, and people have to leave their neighborhoods, and it's also we're basically talking here about conspicuous display of wealth. We're talking about the kinds of barriers that money puts up, in all sorts of different aspects of life, not just in rent, can you live in a neighborhood or can you not? We're talking about vast parts of a city being basically becoming kind of a country club for a certain class of people, and that's unfortunate.
And that seems like at the core of your concern here, that there are two Chicagos and maybe by extension two Americas side by side, a wealthy country club environment here and everybody else in a fairly dangerous, high poverty, high crime zone.
Yeah,
are you worried,
right,
this is going to expand to the rest of the country?
This is happening everywhere. It's particularly noticeable in Chicago because it's noticeable to me because I had, been away for so long, and also because it's the president's hometown. And lastly, because of the sort of really extreme nature of the folly, that has followed in the wake of the money, of the gentrification. But yes, this is happening all over the country. This is what inequality looks like. And in fact, I'm sure it's conceivably worse in other places that I'm not very familiar with. I'm sure you could write the same thing about New York City, only it'd be much, much more intense, or San Francisco or something like that. But those aren't my places.
Well, you look at that income inequality kind of through the lens of food in Chicago, where it seems like this is one place where food is the barometer. What is it about food in Chicago that sort of signals what's going on there?
Yes, and that is exactly the case. This is what Chicago is famous for. So after I moved out of the city, I would sort of keep up to speed on what was going on there, reading the newspapers, and every time I read a story about what was happening in Chicago, it was always about the restaurants and the food scene. And this had never been an important part of life for me when I lived there. I mean, obviously, I ate food. Everybody does. But, going to restaurants was something that was sort of outside my price range. That's just not what I did. I cooked at home. And And yet, so this is always what you hear about. So I wanted to look into it. This kind of intense gastronomy scene that's going on there. And sure enough, it is really extraordinary. Chicago produces has all these sort of world class chefs and these world class restaurants, and the food that they serve and the food that they're renowned for is always like taking some sort of esoteric ingredient and running it through this escalator of complications and preciousness, you know, like injecting it into a hollow sphere of ice, or or turning it into a foam and then deep frying it or something like that, or you know, doing something really outrageous to it. And you know, this is sort of what the city is known for now. Did you see the stories a while ago when Charlie Trotter died? Like, what was that? Mm-hmm. A couple of weeks ago, he was sort of the beginner of the initiator of this style of cuisine in America.
And Thomas, actually, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Man, I was just getting started.
We'll have to have you on again. That's Thomas Frank, founder and editor of the Baffler magazine. We've got a link to the article we've been talking about on the Central Time Facebook page.